This far into the pandemic, those who haven't gotten COVID-19 have been lucky or careful, because there's something strange happening with some people who've gotten sick and are left with long-lasting complications. These patients are being called COVID long haulers, and it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 30% of people who get COVID are stuck with lasting effects. We asked our listeners on our Sci-Fry Vox Pop app to tell us their experiences with long COVID.
I started showing COVID-19 symptoms back at the beginning of November 2020, and I had flu-like symptoms for a couple of weeks, and it cleared up. About a week into the experience, I lost my taste and smell. My taste has slowly come back, but it's now March 2021, and I still can't smell anything.
I got COVID-19 in December. It affected my legs mostly, which are getting much better, but I'm not back to the way I was.
I had COVID in December, and I went down really hard. I still don't have my sense of smell completely back. My taste is still altered. I'm foggy all the time mentally, and I consider it a really, really good day if I don't have to take a nap in the middle of lunch. So I want to know if this is going to be my new reality forever.
Thanks to Michael from Kansas City, Cynthia from Massachusetts, and Catherine from Chicago for sharing their stories. Long-haul COVID is still a mystery in a lot of ways, but there is a lot of work being done to understand it better, and that's what we're going to be talking about with my guests. Dr. Walter Karaschetz is director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda. Dr. David Petrino, director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. David, let me begin with you. Foggy head, loss of taste, smell, limbs not working as well. Are these all typical long-haul symptoms?
Yeah, these are symptoms that sound really familiar to me. We've been tracking this for quite some time now, and some of the most common symptoms that we'll see in this syndrome is cognitive difficulties are present in about 80% of our cohort. Headache, chest pain, shortness of breath, sort of high heart rate and feeling like the heart is beating rapidly in the chest, exercise intolerance, and extreme fatigue. These are some of the cardinal symptoms that we're seeing in roughly 80% of the population.
You know, we say when you have COVID, you have typical symptoms, but there are so many symptoms here. Could it be almost anything?
Yeah, so far we've been tracking over 60 distinct symptoms, and they really do run across the entire body. They're multi-organ, they're multi-system. It can be really baffling to try and track everything that we're seeing. This is why we've started looking toward systems of the body, such as the autonomic nervous system, because the autonomic nervous system can really control lots of things, highly diverse things across the entire body. And it makes some sort of sense when in the context of these symptoms.
Autonomic nervous system means, for our listeners?
The autonomic nervous system is a portion of your nervous system that controls all of the things in your body that you don't ordinarily need to think about controlling, such as when to breathe in and when to breathe out, when your heart should contract and relax, digestion, you know, when your hair should stand on end, and, you know, body temperature. So it's a very diverse system, and ordinarily it doesn't require any conscious effort to control. But if it gets knocked out of balance, it can cause all sorts of very unusual symptoms.
At what point did it become clear that there was something strange going on with regard to long-term effects of COVID?
Well, for us, it was around late April, early May of 2020. We had been using an app to monitor acute symptoms and provide at-home care for people with acute cases of COVID that were not being hospitalized. And we had been running this app from about March of 2020. So by the time we hit late April, early May, we had around 800 people on the platform, and around 10% of the earliest adopters of the app were starting to express concerns about new symptoms that were emerging. and they just really weren't getting better. You know, they'd been on the app. Most people would get on the app and after about 5 weeks, they'd be discharged and thank us and say goodbye. But these people were starting to linger for 2 or 3 months. And all of these symptoms that they were talking about weren't the classic acute COVID symptoms. So at that point, we really started to notice that we were seeing what looked like a post-viral syndrome.
Interesting. Dr. Khurshetz, I want to ask you about this new study that's getting a lot of attention. Researchers found that in the U.S., a third of the people who had COVID developed a psychological or neurological condition within 6 months. This is pretty shocking, is it not?
Yes, I think most of the groups, and David could talk to this, are seeing anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder-like symptoms, usually on top of the more somatic symptoms that he mentioned. And that, I think, is to be expected. Now, the big question is there something that has affected the brain in COVID and the post-COVID period that is also contributing to these difficulties, particularly with concentration, memory, and that goes along heavily with fatigue. I think David mentioned that. And the studies are showing, yes, that these folks, when they're tested, are not performing as you would have expected in terms of their cognitive abilities. And they're telling you that because their main complaint is, you know, they go back to work and they just can't work at that normal level that they did before. Some of them can't go to work. I would say that what should be mentioned is that, you know, in COVID, when you go into that severe stage and you're in the hospital and then you maybe go into the intensive care unit and you have what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, we know that people who have acute respiratory distress syndrome, COVID or no COVID, have long recovery periods and they have a lot of these symptoms that David mentioned. The surprise here with COVID is that many of the people who are suffering these complaints have never been in the hospital. So the CDC did a report out in July looking at non-hospitalized patients, and 35% of them had not returned to baseline health 2 to 3 weeks after their test was positive. And if that was influenza, one would have expected 90% would have been recovered by that time point. And so we really kind of need to get at the bottom of this. And NIH has really ambitious plans to do that. We call it the post-acute sequelae of COVID. It's a very boring technical term, but it kind of meets what it is, says what it is. And so we are going to develop a national program to follow people who have COVID, try and understand, you know, what is the recovery normally in people who recover quickly and how does that differ in people who recover more slowly. And then also to study the people who have persistent symptoms now months out and try and understand what is the biological base of those symptoms, what can we do to kind of alleviate the symptoms and get people healthier again. And the last bit that we really have to understand, which is a little bit off the topic but not entirely, is the fact that COVID has infected so many millions of people that we need to look and see, does it really affect your risk of developing other disorders in the future? Alzheimer's, cardiac disease, for instance. So that's kind of the gist of what the NIH programs are going to go after.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. It seems like you really do need a centralized center there at NIH because it takes in all the different divisions. You have infectious disease, you have neurological, you have all these others, aging. Is that what you're talking about? Are you going to create sort of a new mini division at NIH to study this?
Well, what we're going to create is actually a multi-institute program, which is part of it within NIH itself, but most of it will be out in the university settings or in the community settings. So we envision a large data center where all the data, the imaging data, the blood test data, the genomic data, all flow into this one data center where people will be able to go in and look for associations, a coordinating center that will coordinate all the activities of these multiple different cohorts.
Walter, it's clear that there are a lot of people out there suffering from long COVID symptoms. Many of them are people you deal with. We've heard from a lot of them on our Science Friday Vox Pop app, so I'd like to bring them into the picture from people who are actually suffering from them. Here's a question from Annie in Southern California about one symptom that seems pretty common.
Is there any cures for the lack of smell, which affects your taste?
Right. So the loss of smell is, we think, due to the fact that the virus infects the nasal epithelium, so the surface of your nose, inside your nose. And there are nerve cells there that detect odors and send the signals back into the brain. The good news is, the best evidence is that the virus does not affect the nerve cells themselves, but the supporting cells around those nerve cells. And all those cells can regenerate. So the hope is, and this is the expectation, that these cells will be able to regenerate and your sense of smell will come back again. Couldn't guarantee it'll be exactly as it was, but in general, in similar conditions, that's what you see. You need to wait until the regeneration occurs before you get your sense of smell back.
We have to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation about COVID long haulers when we come back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're continuing our conversation about COVID long haulers, people dealing with health effects months after infection. Here are my guests, Dr. Walter Koroshetz,
offering Snapshot,
Director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda, Maryland,
or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Now that's Progressive.
And from the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at HSFoundation.org. Support also comes from the Research Corporation for Science Advancement, nurturing teacher scholars and innovative basic research in the physical sciences at American and Canadian colleges and universities since 1912. More at WestCorp.org. And from the Winston Foundation, Science Friday is produced by the Science Friday Initiative, dedicated to increasing the public's access to scientific information. ScienceFriday.com.
And I want to know if I have hope of returning to my
previous life, or if this is a chronic illness. You know, a group of elephants is called a herd, a bunch of lions is called a pride.
And that's really hard to live with.
But what is a group of giraffe called?
It's
David,
actually,
do you have an answer
to
that?
Called a tower.
Well, I think that I think that no one has an answer to that right now.
The charismatic giraffe, and why giraffes are suffering from a silent extinction.
We are rapidly
on Science Friday
to work out
from WNYC Studios
about this novel condition. But if we can bring a little bit of comfort to Amy, we've actually just frozen a data set from our first 100 patients that have been through a rehabilitation protocol. We specially designed this rehabilitation protocol for COVID long haulers, and the good news is we're seeing around a 40% improvement in reported symptoms. The bad news is we're seeing this around 40% improvement after about 160 days of the rehabilitation program. So I think what everybody needs to hear at this point is that improvement is possible with careful rehabilitation, but we're looking at a very long road to complete recovery. We have had cases of complete recovery at this point, but these are individuals who have been consistently working with our rehabilitation program for, you know, more than 12 months. So I think that is the time frame that we need to be thinking on. That's the scale that we need to be thinking on when we think about rehabilitation. I think that even then, there's no guarantee that everybody is going to feel the way they did pre-COVID. We still have so much learning to do before we can understand how everybody's going to respond to rehabilitation. And I think also government agencies, CDC, NIH, Social Security Administration, need to brace for this, because from our data set, what we're seeing is that 60% of individuals who are coming to us for care, and we've managed around 950 cases at this stage, tell us that their employment status has changed. And so I think that we all need to be ready for a big influx in people's work status changing, their life status changing for a period of time. And we all need to be prepared with the best science and the best possible care coordination to make sure that all of these individuals who are feeling
exactly like Amy is feeling, completely displaced, like they've lost control of their body. We need to all work together with a lot of compassion to bring them back.
Can you give me an idea about what rehab looks like?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, we have focused a lot of our attention on the idea that many of these symptoms are similar to what we see when people have a condition known as dysautonomia, the autonomic nervous system being thrown out of balance. And when you look into the literature surrounding how to rehabilitate individuals with dysautonomia, there are a number of behavioral interventions where we work around identifying each patient's specific triggers of severe symptoms and give them strategies to avoid those triggers. So to give a concrete example of that, some people will experience a severe attack of symptoms immediately after eating a big meal. That's because in many cases of dysautonomia, stretching out of the stomach will cause an autonomic response that makes them feel like they're about to faint, that their heart is beating rapidly in their chest, and it's incredibly unpleasant, and it can knock them off balance for the rest of the day. So in individuals who get triggered by large meals, of course, we have them working with a nutritionist to help them plan out smaller meals that aren't going to bring on these triggers. There are a diverse number of triggers that we could go through, but we won't because we've got limited time. But the point is, the first thing we start with is you currently feel like you're out of control, your body is out of control. Let's bring some normalcy and some sense to what you're experiencing. So for every identified trigger, we come up with a solution.
And the percentage of patients, you said, who actually are improved after your treatments?
So rather than looking at percentage of patients who are showing recovery, we were talking more about the average recovery in the group. And the average recovery in the group is around 35%.
That's very, very interesting. Walter, is there a certain demographic that seems to be hit harder by neurological symptoms after COVID?
There is certainly, from the reports that are out there, there are more females than males in most of the reports of people with suffering post-acute sequelae of COVID.
Mm-hmm. David, could there be a lot more people who are suffering symptoms out there and don't know that they have, that they're long haulers?
I think that certainly we could have a large number of people who are out there and just not feeling right after their COVID infection and either, you know, don't realize that it's something that they can seek help over, or in fact, you know, don't feel safe seeing a physician to describe their symptoms. You know, a lot of what has been happening early on in the pandemic and is still happening, thankfully to a lesser degree, is there's certainly a lot of medical gaslighting going on in this community. And so I think that right now the demographics may be skewed because we know that historically excluded groups will experience more medical gaslighting. So, you know, women, people of color, et cetera, people with disabilities. And so I think that there could very well be a number of individuals out there who are experiencing these symptoms, but simply don't want to go to the doctor and say, oh, I'm, you know, I had COVID and now I'm feeling, here are some vague subjective symptoms that I'm experiencing. And because I think that they fear what comes next, which is the doctor saying, hey, this is just anxiety, or you're having a panic attack, go home.
Walter, I want to get a message in from another long hauler, Susan from Needham.
I am a COVID long hauler. I just passed the 1 year mark of being exposed to COVID on March 20th, 2020. My question is, I am wondering if there is any research being done on the effects of COVID on the hippocampus. I am losing my cognitive mapping, where I can be driving down the street or I go into a grocery store that I've shopped in for 30 years and I have absolutely no idea where I am. It's as if I have never been in that store in my life. And I know I am not the only one. I've read many articles of other people who are also experiencing these episodes of cognitive mapping loss. So I was wondering if there's anybody looking at that. Thank you.
Could it be cognitive memory loss?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the memory is what people are complaining about. Now, if you think about it, you know, if you have a fever and you have the flu, you're not thinking as quickly, your memory is not as good. We know there are so many things that can influence memory, and certainly fatigue, sleep, if you're having sleep trouble, and potentially even the effects of the virus. So we don't know is whether this is an autoimmune reaction that's been set up by having the virus, whether it's a disturbed immune system. We don't actually even know if the virus is still hiding there somewhere, triggering these troubles. But the memory problems, the attention problems, concentration trouble, that is what you see in people who have numerous rheumatologic conditions, post-concussion. And so there's lots of factors that could be causing that. We have to kind of get at the bottom of it.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. I just have a couple of more questions. I'd like to get to them from our listeners. I want to talk about the vaccines and how they might interact with COVID long haulers, because I want to play a call that we got from Anne in San Diego. Anne suspects she had COVID in March 2020, but did not get tested, so she doesn't know for sure.
The worst symptoms were deep, very painful muscles. After about 8 months, I still couldn't lift either arm to the level of my shoulder. I had the Moderna vaccine starting in January, and it finished in February. And I had one in one arm and one in the other. And at that point, all of the pain went away.
Walter, this seems pretty bizarre, doesn't it? Do we know if the vaccine is altering people's long-haul symptoms?
You know, I think we've heard those type of stories multiple times. And so if that's true, I think that's fantastic that there's some clue there to these symptoms if it goes away after the vaccine. Now, what's the clue? The obvious one is there's some virus still in the body, and the vaccination then, you know, revs up your immune system and gets rid of the virus. But there's lots of other possibilities. It could be the vaccine resets your immune system. There are also people who have, the symptoms have gone away, but then they come back 4 or 5 days later. So I think we need to get, you know, we really, this is great. You know, you have to look around, listen to the patients, as David said, and they can provide the clues. But, you know, this is the one clue that seems worth following up in terms of studying people before and after they get vaccinated, and then see if there's a reaction to the vaccine that's related to improvement. That could help everybody with this condition. But I think at this point in time, we have to kind of get more kind of rigorous data to that point.
Well, in getting the data then, would you recommend that long haulers get vaccinated so
yes.
maybe they could be tracked?
Oh, absolutely. I think that almost everybody should get vaccinated. The exclusion for vaccination are very almost non-existent.
I want to ask you both this question, starting with you, David. It seems like there are a lot of mysteries around long COVID. If you could get the answer to any piece of this puzzle that would really change how you do your job, what would you like to learn?
Well, this may sound very reductive and very simple, but leading right back to when I mentioned that word, the pathophysiology of long COVID, we are currently managing symptoms. We are currently using our best guess at rehabilitation approaches, and those rehabilitation approaches are working, albeit slowly. I think that we could just become so much more targeted, both with therapeutics and rehabilitation, if we understood why this is happening in the body. So, I mean, if I could snap my fingers and understand one thing, it would be what is happening in the body that is causing this physiological change that is leading to this incredibly debilitating multi-system, multi-symptom condition. Once we understand why it's happening, then we can think about targeted treatments as opposed to more generalized treatments.
Walter, same question to you.
Well, I have the same answer with a different twist, and that is that what I would like to know is what's the difference between those people who have the same degree of illness from COVID who get better quickly versus those who don't get better for months and months. And I think this is the opportunity we have to get at that. And I think that's going to shed a lot of light on this problem and potentially other conditions like ME/CFS.
I'd like to end with one question from Katie, or a statement and a question from Washington State.
Is this a life sentence? Because I got sick a year ago, and I was in New York City, and I moved myself across America. I got treatment in Seattle, and now I'm in Wenatchee, Washington, and I'm still doing miserable. So I'd just like to know, is there hope for us out there?
Research is hope. There's hope through research. We have to get to the bottom of it to help people. You can't lose hope.
I've never heard anybody, any researchers say they have enough money to do what they need to do. So, but I'm going to ask you, Walter, with this new cohesive approach, is there enough money being thrown at it to create this network that you're talking about?
Well, we don't throw money here at NIH.
Isn't that the truth?
Well, that's why I asked. I said, I've never heard a scientist say I have enough money to do anything.
Point, yeah, well, Congress realized this was a problem, and they appropriated $1.15 billion for this problem. And that's really given us the chance to go at it in a big way. So this is a real substantial research initiative, thanks to the wisdom of Congress.
David? How do you answer that question for yourself?
I would agree. I've been absolutely overwhelmed by the responsiveness of the NIH, the CDC, the Social Security Administration reaching out to my team, asking for data, asking, for anything that they can do to understand this problem and get at this problem. So, I think that I've never seen this level of cooperation across health systems, across government agencies. I really hope that that continues. I really hope that we can all just, make a concerted effort to work together to really unlock these puzzles so that individuals such as the last caller who are really concerned, is this a life sentence, we can give them some hope. I totally agree with Walter. Where there's research, there's hope. We're working as fast as we can. This is a brand new condition. And the more that we can all organize together and be collectivist in our approaches, the better chance we have to help these people out.
Well, I hope we have given some people some hope today. We've certainly given them a lot of information. And I want to thank both of you for taking extra time to be with us today. Dr. Walter Karashets, Director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda. Dr. David Putrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System in New York, New York. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to hear a longer version of this conversation, we had so much more to talk about, go to our website, sciencefriday.com/longhaulers. Charles Berquist is our director. Our producers are Christy Taylor, Katie Feather, and Kathleen Davis. Senior producer, Alexa Lim. Our contributing editor is John Dankosky. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. One last thing before we go. We're celebrating Citizen Science Month throughout April, and we've partnered with the Great Sunflower Project for a pollinator palooza. Yeah, so find out more on our website, sciencefriday.com/citizenscience.